Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Hi, my name is Vivian Aqua, and I'm a certified DEI trainer, coach, consultant. And for those of you who haven't seen the previous session or the previous live stream, please watch the topic of the menopause topic, because that was truly an interesting conversation as well. And also know that at the moment, right now, I am supporting different companies, different leaders, different managers, different people with amplifying diversity, equity, and inclusion within. And for those of you who don't know yet, right, look at my newsletter, or I'll try to find the link to help you out. But within my newsletter, I at the moment have right now an end of year offer from Amplify DEI. So when you book your session, your workshop, your coaching, workshop or training before the 15th of December this year, you can get a 20% discount on my services, right? So just to let you know that I'm here to support you, and also to let you know that this is an end of year offer, which I'm only offering till the 15th of December as well. But today's topic is going to be about enhancing team dynamics, the neuroscience behind empathy in the workplace. And for that, I have a special guest speaker, which I'm gonna have a look to her bio. So excuse me for looking away. So I have here Dr. Skyla Harrod, PhD, and she is a behavioral scientist, also DEI expert, and helping organizations tackle bias and build resilience with a science-backed insights, right? So she uses different strategies based upon science, but also believes in humanizing the workplace with practical neuroscience. So thank you, Skyla, for saying yes. We have had interesting encounters. So to demystify, I met Skyla at an event earlier this year, but I never had a chance to talk to her at the event. So we reached out afterwards and had a good conversation. But I took her to my aunt's restaurant, which is GoCo's in Amsterdam. And I wasn't aware that Skyla was already familiar with the Ghanaian cuisine. So here I am inviting her, bringing in some plantains and spice and pepper. And normally, you know, when I invite people, I always tell them, like, okay, I don't know where your spice level is at, but just take a pinch and taste and see where it had. Well, Skyler ended up taking more than a pinch.
Yes, and then I brought a container back for more.
Yeah.
Just dig right in with the spice. Exactly. Yeah, I love it.
I love it. So we had a good heart-to-heart conversation. And also, it's amazing to meet different people where you feel aligned with each other. And I had that with Skyler as well. So I think I met Skyler through Dr. Marsha Goddard, who's also a dear friend of mine. So, but let's dig in to your interrogation, right, of today.
Great.
So why do you think we need to humanize the workplace, especially when you come from with your neuroscience background?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it is super important to humanize the workspace, and why this is now my new mission as a neuroscientist, because we as a society, as a people, have just been through so much massive change just within our lifetimes, Vivian. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about, like, first the tech revolution, and then the the internet, and then social revolutions, and work from home in 2020, and generative AI, like, everything is changing about society, education, and the workforce. And people are realizing, I think, for the first time, that people are no longer willing to sell their soul to the CEO anymore, right? And the companies are finally waking up to realize that humans are their greatest asset, but also their greatest risk, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about the typical problems that face most companies, most of them come out of human behavioral interactions, whether that's an HR issue, or it's an ethics and compliance, or it's a diversity and inclusion issue. So it's become apparent to me, as someone who has spent 20 years in academia, that scientists are generally really bad about explaining science to the general
generally
public.
Mostly of the time, because when scientists talk about things, and that's why I like the conversation that we have, but also with the scientists that I've gotten to know that add a lot of human level into their engagement, because oftentimes it feels like scientists are talking to their own bubble and not being able to connect, at least to connect to me on a heart-to-heart level, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think that just comes out of the nature of the way that academia has been built. It is quite an ivory tower and it's very isolated. Yeah. But at the end of the day, like, if we're not doing science in order to help people, then what are we doing it for? Like, why are we even here?
I love that one. Yeah.
So, you know, I spent a long time in academia training future scientists and doctors and researchers and running a research lab myself. And I have since moved towards starting to take a lot of those insights that I have researched personally, that I've taught from others' research, and start applying it in society, in social settings and educational settings and in corporations where people can actually benefit from the insights that actually science has known for a really long time. And we've just been keeping it to ourselves. So I see it really as an extension of democratizing science for everyone. Right. And it out of a necessity, really, of just where we are in the world. Like, we're not going to go back and do that anymore. So
true. Yeah. I agree. Okay, let's talk about the brain, the neuroscience, and also how does neuroscience define empathy, and why is it crucial for team dynamics, team building?
Yeah. So this is a great question, and one I get asked a lot, right? Because often people confuse empathy and sympathy. So empathy from a neuroscience perspective. Mm-hmm. First of all, empathy and sympathy activate completely different brain regions.
Exactly.
So let's just start there and say from a hard science perspective, these experiences are very different. And here's the difference. Empathy involves you sharing or having the capacity to share a mental state, a perspective, or a set of emotions with another person, right? It involves you, or your brain rather, imagining that you are in that scenario and feeling everything that comes up from your brain's imaginary, you know, creation. Sympathy is you observing someone who is sad or in pain or hurting and feeling bad yourself. It does not require that you experience any of their emotions firsthand. It does not require that you put yourself in their cognitive headspace to try and understand their rationale or where they're coming from. It's just your own biologically selfish reaction to someone else's pain. And that I don't say selfish in a bad sense, right? Sympathy as empathy are good things because they have evolved as a process of humans,
you say it's good thing, but the way that I have registered sympathy and also empathy comes from an authentic place, where sympathy feels to me performative. It feels to me inauthentic because you're centering yourself instead of somebody else or supporting them from that lens, right?
Yes. And I love that you stopped me there, because this is a perfect example of why it's important to get your communication and your definitions correct when you're talking from different
angles,
right? Yeah. So when I say sympathy and empathy are good things because they have evolved with the human species, what I mean is, first of all, they've evolved because they're here. We have the capacity to have them, right? So they've evolved with our brain. Yeah. And it's part of something we call social pain experience. And what that means is that scientists believe we have actually evolved sympathy as a form of group protection, right? So that one individual as a pack animal would notice someone else in their pack who's in pain there's a very good chance that that pain might also affect them. Does that make sense? So it's good for the continuation of the species. It's not very good for developing authentic relationships. And it's not very good for collaborating or communicating, right? So when we look at it from, you know, a big scale scientific perspective, it's good for the human species, but is it on an individual level?
No. Yeah. I also have a comment in from Judith. I think I'm not sure if I know Judith, but anyway, I'll read it up. Science applied in the workplace, especially neuroscience, is very valuable for teams, organizations, but also with growing use of AI instance. Ooh, you're bringing up a whole nother topic. Maybe we can tweak it in.
That's next
maybe
week.
You can tweak it. But thank you, Judith, for bringing it up. And maybe we can tweak it in. So you talked about the individual person. Why is empathy then important for teams dynamics as well?
Yeah, that's great. So empathy is super critical for team dynamics because it fosters collaboration and better communication. Okay. So we have those two things, collaboration and communication, then we can make better decisions as a
team.
Okay? So your individual biology then affects team dynamics and team dynamics affects the organization health, right? So empathy, I think, is really important in terms of collaborating and communicating, because we can actually see in, for example, an fMRI scanner, what happens to individuals' neural networks when they start talking to each other.
Do you have images of that as well? Maybe I can share it later in a post.
I would or love maybe, to send you images of that. But essentially, there have been quite a few famous research studies that have been done that have tracked neural brainwave patterns from different individuals who were in isolated social settings or in a room but not interacting with each other. And we see that once two people start speaking to each other, you get what's called neural synchronization. And that means that your brainwave patterns start to line up with that other person's brainwave patterns when you are communicating and understanding what each other are saying. Now, the fact that that happens naturally, like scientists did not create that, we just discovered that this happens naturally. This shows us that humans are wired. We have evolved this ability to understand and relate to that other person's perspective. And I think it's an evolutionary advantage as well, right? The more we understand another person, the better we can collaborate with them. But this aspect of understanding our communication, again, is so nuanced in the science that it's often lost on where we can apply it in a day-to-day basis. So what I love about bringing science to the workplace is that just by a little bit of awareness, right, that this is something that already happens in our brain. And if we do these things, we can actually amplify what we already have as a capacity for high performance.
I love what you shared. And I had to Google, and I know that I have to be careful with
Are you
Googling, right? But I went to a site, Science Direct, which I know that they are offering good tips, right? So I'm going to share it with you so that you know that I did my best to fact check. So let me see.
Thank you.
It's from Elsevier, where they talk about a study, Suffer Together, Bond Together, brain-to-brain synchronization, and mutual effective empathy when sharing painful experiences. I haven't read it, but what I noticed was there was an image there, sharing painful experiences, empathy, and social bond. And that is what I see when I do the virtual reality training, where I am able to amplify and unlock empathy for those who haven't experienced, or those who are, let's say, those who haven't experienced exclusion on a bigger level, to be able to understand how exclusion on one person is impacting not only the leader, the team, but also the organization. Yeah. And oftentimes, this is something that so many people don't understand or don't stand still for, because they think that, well, it's that's the only person who's suffering. But the impact that it has on the team is when the moment that that person isn't collaborating or communicating effectively, the moment that they are not participating from a perspective where they can create, they can innovate, and also can amplify the productivity, energy is infectious. So if I bring in negative energy to the workplace, then I'm able to affect all the other people within my team. And that will have also a negative impact on your team goals and so much more, right? So I'm grateful for you sharing science on a human level, make it normal for the normal people, right? Because this is where I have to demystify a little bit something else. So I'm dyslexic, and sometimes reading long texts that isn't romantic or isn't talking to me in a human level, I zone out. So for you to share, you know, the little things where I'm able also to dive in deep and bring in some, did I do well, by the way, by bringing in that topic?
You did so well. I want to go back and talk about why it creates social bonding. Do you know why it creates social bonding?
No.
Not just the empathy, but for our listeners and watchers, when you start to activate these empathy networks and start to build your collaboration and communication with another person, it actually causes a release of the hormone oxytocin in your
oxytocin, the natural way, though.
Other people, right? So oxytocin is sometimes called the love hormone or the bonding hormone. It's what is released during labor and delivery, for example. And there have been some fascinating studies that show, especially team leaders, like executive leadership, when they display vulnerability to their teams, you can actually measure the increase in oxytocin produced by their team members. And what that means on a behavioral level is that they feel more trust, more bonding, and more of a motivation to work together as a team.
I have seen, I don't know if it's the same study, but I've seen a study that Catalyst has done where people work under an empathic leadership, and I'm going to look it up. I'm going to fact check this as well. Look it up. They are thriving more in the workplace, more engaged and more innovative than when they are not working under a leader who's empathetic. Right. So that's very crucial as well, because what you're bringing up, I also want to bring in some comments, because people are responding to our conversation. So Rabia is sharing sympathy versus empathy. Yes, that's something that many people confuse, and it's great that Skylar is also bringing it up. And Judith, you are always welcome to share your insights and your questions. That's what it's here for, right? And Tanya is sharing a great perspective. So thank you, Tanya, for sharing that. In the meantime, I want to ask you a question, and I'll look up the facts from Catalyst regarding working on her. Yeah, that's how I am. So let's bring up the following thing, right? Because you explained something about the emotional intelligence and empathy, right? Something a little bit about that. So I need to bring in some other question. What are some common misconceptions about empathy in the workplace that neuroscience can help clarify?
Great question. I'd say the first misconception is our discussion about sympathy versus empathy. That's a big one. People confuse those two. Another misconception is that I hear a lot is that empathy is a soft skill, that it's a nice to have, that it's not really a requirement for real leaders. I've even heard once from someone who shall not be named, that empathy comes as a result of more women in the workforce. That was cute. Clearly, this is all nonsense. Empathy is a human skill that is a result from the way that our brains are wired. Mm-hmm. It is crucial for healthy development. It is crucial for healthy relationships. And if you don't believe me, then just reflect on the relationships in your own life. Yeah. Think about the relationships in your own life and how much empathy there is between you and that other person versus someone with whom you may not have a good relationship and feel that you're not heard, you're not understood. I think organizations are starting to understand that empathy is an important skill, but they still see it as an emotional intelligence skill, which is okay, but it's still sort of in that nice to have category.
True. And
my mission is really to convince people that empathy and lots of other leadership qualities like active listening and vulnerability and growth mindset, cognitive flexibility, all of these are requirements for high performance executive leadership who responds well and works well with their team.
I love that. And I wasn't aware that this conversation would spark so much in me that I want to share things, right? So this is a starting point for me to lead towards the empathy and empathy deficit and how people are thriving on an empathic leadership. So this is happening at the moment with employee engagement in worldwide, where so many people are not thriving. When you count the loud quitting, when you count the quiet quitting, this is what happening, where 23% of the global workforce is thriving and 13% of the European workforce is thriving, right? The numbers are much more depressing when you look at the different countries. But then again, I also have to bring in that at the moment right now, there is a survey that Business Solver did where they surveyed, you know, different employees working from a company, and they said that their organization is 25 sufficiently empathic. So that means 75%, there is a 75% empathy deficit.
Yeah.
So yeah, going towards that, it's definitely not good.
Yeah.
I did a topic for students as well, but it should be impact on employee engagement. So this is the thing that I was referring to earlier on, when people are able to work with a senior leader or a leader that is empathetic, they are 61%, you know, able to innovate at the workplace. And when they are working with it under an empathic leader who shows high empathy level, 76%. It's not me that I'm making these up. These are studies. Why? And I'm preaching to the choir when we are talking about this, because I love empathy and I love how its impact on people. But I also realize with the current state of the world, polarization, the conversations that we are not having, the courageous conversations that is needed to lead towards empathy, and also that you can use different tools to unlock empathy or to amplify empathy. That is, you know, that's also one of the reasons why I wanted us to have this conversation, because we were having this conversation while we were having dinner or to the chat, right?
Yeah. And I love that you brought this up. I mean, this is a critical issue that I don't believe will go away. I mean, again, we're talking about a changing workforce, and I don't believe it's ever going to go back to the way that it was before. People have finally said, you know what, I've had enough. And if this company is not going to X, Y, and Z, then I will find a new company. I mean, this is not just an issue for high performance in your team. It's a basic issue for like retention, right?
Just to bring it there, because retention, people forget that the older generation who is working at so many companies right now, they are going to retire faster at the moment right now. And that's a huge chunk of the population.
Yeah.
No matter where you are in the US, no matter where you are in Europe, in the Netherlands, in the UK, there will be a huge gap, and so many companies are not looking into this factor. What I've seen has worried me, where now a lot of Gen Zs are being fired just because they are not complying towards the traditional setting or the traditional leadership, right?
Yeah.
The comment section is booming. So please share, and then I'll bring in the comments.
Yeah, I mean, my question about that previous image that you had up is, I'm curious what the breakdown is from executive leadership versus the rest of the company. Because if I were a betting woman, I would say that if you gave that same survey to the executive leadership, they'd say, oh my gosh, this is such an empathic place to work. We understand our employees so well, and we want to support them, blah, 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 blah. But clearly there's a disconnect between your intentions and your actions. And that is another way that neuroscience can come in and help bridge those two, right? By understanding what it is about our brains that creates this gap between what we say we want to do and who we say we are, and then how we actually make decisions or behave in a certain situation. That's why these types of conversations are so important.
I know that, I don't know if Catalyst did something like that, but I do know that the source or Business Solver did a perception of leaders, you know, what they think when it comes to empathy in the workplace and how empathetic their workplace is. And of course, the number is so much higher. It's positive even.
Yeah, of course.
Whereas the employees or the normal people did the survey, and this is what the outcome was, right? So the perception and intention were, let's say the intention was something else, but the perception, how their intention were perceived, that was so much different as well.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you.
Oh, I was just gonna say that this is one of the reasons why bias training, unconscious bias training, is so important. Right,
impactful because, unconscious bias training, though.
Yes, of course.
Because Harvard, you know, Harvard HBR did an article about so many unconscious bias training are stopping where they should start, right? And also, I mean, I have to, you know, pitch in what I do and what we do, right? When you're able to tap into people, their brain, and connect it to their heart, and also tap into their intrinsic motivation, that's where the training starts. So with you being a neuroscientist, where you explain things about the brain, but also explain how people collaborate together, and with me using virtual reality, using real scenarios, no avatar, but real scenarios, so that people can see the invisible impact or the invisible harm that is done upon people. So I'm basically opening them up to trauma, soft trauma, where they can see that the hurt that you are making with your comment or the things that you do or the workplace that is inclusive for you cannot be perceived inclusive for somebody else. And that perception, so the whole merit and meritocracy, in a way I believe in it, but in a way we also have to be real that what is good for you, for your career, because you are you with your background, isn't automatically going to apply to me or to you or to somebody else, right? So we have to be open about that as well.
Yeah. And Vivian, this is also why I love what you do with the VR, because I know that you know this at some level, but I think that you're also quite humble in talking about it, that you
are. Am I humble?
Yeah, in the sense, yeah. That you are, through using the VR with your client, you are, in a sense, hacking their brain to trick them into activating all of these regions to unlock empathy, right? Ooh. And you're doing that by tricking their brains into thinking with this immersive VR experience that their brain is experiencing it. And this, for me, as a scientist, is why using VR for empathy is so much more effective than a traditional workshop and let's talk about our feelings, because oftentimes that does not break the selfish barrier that our brains have with other people. It does not activate our mirror neurons so that we can understand what other people are going through. It doesn't activate our prefrontal cortex. We just hear it and then get defensive, because no one wants to think that they're not empathetic, right? But when you use the VR and when you use scientific tools to explain, look, this is just how our brains work. They're set up to make all of these shortcuts and bad guesses and categorical decisions to preserve yourself. It's like your brain only evolved to keep you alive. It's not trying to make you happy. It's not trying to make you rich. So it makes mistakes. But yeah. I think as people, we think that we just make decisions and they're all perfect and logical and reasonable all the time.
And also we are afraid to make mistakes, right? The people that, you know, there is a fear associated when you talk about DEI, for instance, making that mistake and not applying your growth mindset to learn from it, yeah, so that you can do better, right? So
yeah,
with virtual reality, you can step on somebody's toes without literally stepping on somebody's toes, yeah, but still experience the impact of you stepping on somebody's toes, but also feel connected to that. So I have something else that I want to share. I feel like it's a whole factual
I love it. Are you kidding? This is sharing a great back and forth conversation. I love it.
So PwC did a study for why virtual reality is often better than traditional training. The ideal situation is to use it for blended learning. So to combine it with VR training, combine it with traditional training, and combine it with online training, right? I'm not saying that online training should be redundant. Also, offline training should be redundant, but VR has a better impact. And the fact that people are 275% more confident because they were allowed to play around in a virtual space to experience, so that the next time when they are going through that experience, that they know how it felt,
yeah,
and how it excluded other people, but also they know what to do because you are able to tap into their intrinsic motivation. I have to add a disclaimer. I'm talking about virtual reality, and oftentimes people connect it with Meta and other scenarios, right? I want to make sure that I put an emphasis on I'm using real scenarios, so with real people, because I don't know if you are a gamer, and if for the people that are not gamers, they don't connect well with avatars, right? So I want to make sure that using real scenarios, because it's so real that it could be maybe your aunt or your uncle or maybe your daughter, right? To share this and also create that better connectiveness as well.
Yeah, because that is the feature that actually makes it impactful to your brain. Because in a sense, it's like, you know, have you heard of doctors using things like music therapy with stroke patients to get them to recover words, right? Yeah. So what you see in those instances is that people who have lost the ability to speak can suddenly sing a song. And the reason why is because you're activating all of these other brain regions, which may not have to do with words like rhythm and notation and melody and all of those things, but that are neurally linked with the words. So it's like lighting a fire next to the thing you want to set on fire. Right.
I've seen something similar also for people who stutter or people who sound different when they talk normally. But when they sing, you hear it's like a different person who's singing as well.
Yeah. And that's because music incorporates all of these different brain regions that just speech does not. It's basically three regions, you know, for speech. But by using this different tool, you can elevate the temperature or the activity of all of the cells so that you eventually get that one jumped, right?
Yeah.
And VR works in a very similar way because these are immersive experiences. And to an extent, I think neuroscience awareness does as well, because I'm not an activist. I'm a scientist. I'm not coming to tell you how to live your life. I don't have any preset agendas. I'm just explaining that this is the way that all human brains are wired, generally speaking, right? We have talks about neurodiversity as well, but there are certain bugs in the system, if you will. And we aren't going to fix those bugs, right? Yeah, it's not like the movie Lucy, where you can just, you know, suddenly have perfect brain power. But what we can do is understand the behaviors that are linked to those brain regions and focus on improving those, which will then activate those brain regions and make everything easier.
Okay, I have to attend the comments. Like I said, Skyla, I think that we are might be going a little bit off script. I crafted a whole list of 10 questions, and she was asking me, like, I don't know if I am able to answer them all. And as you can see, we have a lot of questions. So let me start with Tanya. Tanya is sharing great perspective, first of all. Then Agnes is sharing, this is a great discussion. Thank you, Agnes, for sharing
Thank you.
It's a collaboration between us. And also Judith said, I literally heard that all that fuzzy and fluffy stuff. Is good for all. It's not only for women, it's good for all. As you can see, next time when somebody says fluffy, show them this video, show them this conversation, share the facts, and let them decide, right? Or let them undergo the virtual reality. And Tanya has a question. Let me see. Vivian and Dr. Herod, have you seen any examples where empathy as a performance metric? That's an interesting one. Yeah.
Like empathy as a performance metric. Mm-hmm. I would love to see that already incorporated into an existing structure or an existing institution that brings empathy in as a performance metric alongside profit margins and everything else. I have yet to see that.
I haven't seen it as well.
I have seen an increase in internal department conversations around empathy and bias, linking them to high performance, which is for me essential. I think that's key. But no, we're not there yet. I mean, that's our goal, right? Like I think that in the future we will be looking at a lot more metrics of success, and they will not just have decimals after them, right? Like these are human metrics. And there are people like myself and Dr. Goddard and others who do work with companies to try and assess, okay, what are your behavioral metrics here? What are your struggles as a team? How can we come in and work with you on that? So there's no shortage of support systems out there, but it's about being self-aware enough of you and your team and your organization to say, I wonder if maybe we're not making huge mistakes, but maybe we could just do better. Yeah. And
that do better, it's often missed, because when I look back in my career, I can only count, I think I had 3 employees or 3 environments where team coaching and team building, training and support was being brought to light. And here I am, I'm just thinking about how come that this element wasn't a given aspect, right?
Yeah. Because as we said at the onset, I mean, humans are the biggest asset and the biggest risk to organizations. Yeah. So if you're not investing in those assets that you have, you're risking even more. So
I love that quote. I love it. I'm going to bring in another question from Tanya. So you mentioned that empathy can unfortunately be perceived to belong to one gender. How can we challenge gender perceptions of empathy? I would say share this conversation. It's online as well, or tag the people, or share it. How do you say it? Share it discreetly, right? So call in by sharing this conversation via LinkedIn message so that they can have a look or listen to this conversation as well. That's my take. What would you share?
I would also say pay attention to things like gendered communication. Gendered communication in leadership is a big issue that women face. We have internalized the way that we speak to people when we ask questions at the end and we say, I don't know, does that make sense? You know, that we're like making ourselves smaller, apologizing all the time. So there are consistent patterns in communication across gender spectrums, and there are communication differences as well.
I wanna stop on what you just shared right now, because you just ran through it like it's nothing. Sorry. And I just want to put an emphasis on, so the way that I interpret what Skylar just mentioned right now is, I would have to say that many women are doing this a lot, apologizing mm-hmm. when you mm-hmm. haven't stepped on my toe or hurt mm-hmm. me.
Stop. I know, I do this all the time with you. We talk about this in our personal relationship.
Stop saying sorry. And also making things smaller. If you have a big idea or a different perspective, don't minimize it.
Yeah.
Don't minimize it. I just wanted to amplify what you just shared right now, because you just ran through the next one. Wait a minute.
I did. I think because I've already come to peace with it, and I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. this is crap. Let's stop doing
that. No, it's not.
You're right. There are a lot of women and younger women still who mm-hmm. are still doing this. Mm-hmm. And look, I understand. I still do it myself. It is so difficult because we have internalized this way to behave.
Yeah.
And really it was out of self-preservation.
Yeah.
Right. You don't want to be too confrontational. You don't want to be too argumentative. Still to this day, women are far more affected by the halo and horn effect, which is a cognitive bias that associates certain characteristics with overall competence. So for example, there are two characteristics that women have, which will statistically have them invited back fewer than any other quality for a job interview. And those characteristics are body size. And the only thing more impactful than body size is frowning. So this is an example yet again of all of these biases that come into effect women, whereas you might be entering the organization thinking that you're on the same level. If you're working with a female colleague, she may not be perceiving everything the way that you are, right? And that's why, as you said, these team trainings are so important. Yes, halo and horn effect. So the halo effect says that we confuse socially likable traits with overall confidence. And the horn is just the opposite, right? We confuse unlikable traits with a distrust or lack of confidence. So organizations will often use this when they want to do celebrity branding, right? Like, I love Beyonce, Beyonce loves Pepsi, therefore I like Pepsi now. Just kidding, Beyonce, I hate Pepsi. I can't even do that for you. But that's an idea of halo effect, right? And it impacts people in the workplace all the time, especially when people are coming up for promotions, in job interviews.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that needs to be discussed. And it doesn't need to be discussed in a shaming way. I have experiences with companies where they don't want to talk about this because the trainings that they've had in the past are basically HR coming in and saying, you're all terrible people and you should be doing X, Y, and Z. And that's just not effective.
And that's also why I talk about DEI from a light perspective, right? It's not that I know it's a heavy topic. I know bringing this up, it can stir the pot. But I am sharing a wink, wink to Beyonce. For people who really know me, they know that I'm a Beyonce fan. And to me, when Beyonce does something or does something wrong, she can never do no wrong for me because she has a halo. Whereas, let's say there's a, I'm not going to name his name, but there's a media mogul right now in prison who's going through a lot at the moment right now. And there's a lot of hate, a lot of things that, you know, that people say that he has done, right? I'm not going to end up going to that debate, but there's a lot of hate towards him where at the moment right now, he's dealing with the horns effect because of that situation that's happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, you know, just one of, I think, count 188 cognitive biases that have been researched and published. And that's what I would love, I guess, for the future, for companies for the future. There we go. Yeah. All 188 of those cognitive biases. And this is what I love, right? Because people think we're so logical, we're so rational.
No, we're not. We're not.
Until you start explaining how the brain works and what bias is and how it evolves. And
yeah.
And then it's like, oh, well, I get it served the purpose then, but it's not really serving my purpose in 2024.
And people find this chart fascinating, right? They find it fascinating because it now makes a little bit more sense into what's happening in the workplace and how we enter the workplace with all these different cognitive biases that challenge us to collaborate with people, challenge us to empathize with them or to collaborate with them. But
that's right.
I feel like we have deviated from the conversation. I want to talk more about empathy, and maybe we need to do a part two to address the other things. But sure, let me ask, this is a question that I need to ask because we have shared the value of empathy. We have talked about the lack of empathy. We have also explained what empathy is and how the effect is on the brain. But I want to also give a gift, a present to leaders. So what practical strategies can leaders implement to cultivate empathy within their team using neuroscience insights?
Great question. So the first tip of advice I always give is to expand your in-group. And if you don't know what that means, in-group, out-group bias is one of those 188 biases. It's one of the earliest formed biases that says everyone who looks like me is safe. Everyone who doesn't look like me is not safe. And that's just something that comes from from our own evolutionary biological way of wiring.
We connect with people we like, right? That's also one of the reasons why when you see a CV see a resume and you see that the person went to the same high school or same university or grew up in the same place, you connect with them. And you want to bring them in. Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
So, and neuroscience shows that people in our out groups, we do not tend to even try to understand them. Mm-mm. We categorize them even on a facial recognition perspective. So there are literally two brain regions for facial recognition. Mm-hmm. One categorizes and one focuses on the features. So it's very different brain processing for people who are in your outgroups, people who are different from you. So the biggest tip I always give is to expand your outgroup and your in-group. And to do this, I recommend actually watching a documentary on a people group or a sports or whatever it is that makes that person part of your outgroup. And the reason that I say watch a documentary about that is one, so that you're not putting the burden of explaining that person and their culture and their history on the person, do your own homework.
Yeah.
And second of all, documentaries are great because they often tap into the emotional element of understanding these people, right? More than other shows. Mm-hmm. So by activating your own limbic system, it tricks your brain into thinking, oh, this person isn't in my outgroup. I know them. And neuroscience shows that even a single 10-minute conversation with someone can change the neural patterns from thinking of that person as an out-group to thinking of them as an in-group. And that, of course, affects empathy.
Yeah, and I also want to bring in something else, right? Because I'm going to say we are leaders. We don't have time to watch documentaries, so I want to bring in something else. Listen to podcast conversations while you are traveling, while you are away, or while you are in the car or commuting.
Walking the dog. Yeah.
Connect with, listen to or watch TED Talks that are connected to this topic, right? So that you listen to a TED Talk that maybe you would normally not select by somebody who you don't know, who's totally different from you. And listening to their talk can open your horizon. I hope that I'm not butchering her name, but Chimamanda, she has a beautiful TED Talk about the single side story. I'm going to look it up to make sure that I have that. And she talks about the danger of the way the Western society looks upon Africa, like Africa is needs sympathy instead of empathy.
Right.
Because of this factor, Africa is missing so many grants, so many money, because there is a single side narrative story that's out there of Africa, but not everyone in Africa is poor. Why not everybody is living outside is dealing with hunger or is in war or is dealing with corruption, right? So we have to make sure that we look at the narrative, the story, that there are two sides to each story.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's a great way for me to even expand my own in-group in a way that makes me feel more confident than to approach that person and interact with them, right? Because I feel like, okay, I've educated myself a little bit. Mm-hmm. Something else that I would recommend doing is appointing a devil's advocate in meetings. And what this means is, ahead of time, pointing out a person or a group of people whose job it is to argue against you. And not in a mean way.
To challenge you.
Purpose, to challenge you, right?
Yeah.
Because we are riddled, as we said, with these biases. And one of the biggest ones is our bias blind spot. So that comes from our brain's ability and almost addictive-like need to explain event cause and effect. Like our brain is wired to explain cause and effect. And so if we aren't tapping into that, then we're just going to start rationalizing our biased decision. So it helps to have someone with an outside perspective who can more easily see your bias and challenge you on that. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be someone that you appoint ahead of time, not just someone in the moment, because one, that it'll always be the same person. And two, it'll just feel annoying and frustrating for that person if they always feel like they have to challenge.
And also somebody who has carte blanche to give you constructive feedback.
Yes. Yeah.
So look at the hierarchy level of the authority level, right? Because if that person is working under you or working within your team and you have power and privilege to do something with their career in a negative way, you have to be very careful about that. So find somebody maybe outside of your department or somebody outside of the company who will help you with this. And I wanted to also bring back the TED Talk. So the TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, that's her name, she's Nigerian. And she talks about our lives, our cultures, our compass with many overlapping stories. And she tells the story of how she found her authentic cultural voice and warned, what if we only hear a single story about another person or a country, or better yet, a continent? We risk a critical misunderstanding. So this is maybe your homework or assignment, or this is a homework or assignment for those who want to do better and challenge their in and out group, but also test your gut, find in your gut or find reflect upon the following question. Why is it that this story resonate, or why is it that this story doesn't resonate? Is it because of the speaker? Why are you feeling conflicted with that, right? So challenge yourself to think like Socrates and ask yourself reflective questions.
Yeah, and I think bearing in mind while you're asking those questions, just remember that this is an ongoing process of development and self-awareness.
Yes.
So I do like to share with people that when you start becoming aware of your own biases and how maybe you have not shown empathy in places that you now realize you should have, that feels gross. It does not feel good. It does not feel good to learn that you have, maybe without even knowing it, not behaved in the way that you intended to, right? Your intentions aren't lined up with your actions. And so yeah. I would say for those people who are starting that journey, to be encouraged and continually motivated in that, because mm-hmm. we are all on that journey. And it's true. Not like, it's never fun for any of us when someone points out like, ooh, you do this thing and that's not really, it made mm-hmm. me feel this way. But when you start to realize how many ways your brain is wired just to protect you and not worry about anyone else, mm-hmm. it becomes very important that, okay, this is something that I need to work on yeah. so that my brain and behavior can be aligned, that I can be happy in the workplace, and that the overall organizational health is at its best.
And you can do it together with an accountability partner, right? Or somebody absolutely. Who you like and trust, but also to demystify, because oftentimes there is this misconception amongst those who are working in the field of diversity, equity, inclusion, that we don't have biases. But I'm human. Skylar is also human. Every human, every person yeah. is dealing with biases.
Yeah.
Unconscious or conscious, we're dealing with biases, period. Right. So please challenge those who don't think that they have any biases, because every human, every person here on this globe has biases, period.
Yeah.
I want to bring in two comments. Okay. Rawia did mention about the music therapy
yes.
being used also for dementia and Alzheimer's. Yes.
That's right. Because it works in the same way. It's like activates neurons that are close to those neurons, and it gets them excited, and then they just start working.
And thank you, Judith, for joining this session as well. Great for having you here. And also great for those who commented as well. Rabia says, valid point, and as it is important that we show some self, yes, let's show grace and self-compassion to mm-hmm. us. Yes, yes, because there's no shame in you discovering this, but that's now right. you know, right? Like Maya Angelou says, when you know better, you got to do better. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not easy, but the more you train, the more you challenge yourself, and the more you involve your accountability partner on this journey, that's where I feel like you can do so much more good than yeah. harm. I told Skylar like it would take like 40 minutes, 35 minutes, but it's already an hour, and I feel like this needs to be continued.
Yeah, so I could talk about the brain forever, so
I'm gonna have a chat with Skylar, see how we are going to continue this conversation. It might be though the beginning of next year, but I definitely enjoyed this conversation, and it went in the direction that I knew it would go in, into unscripted, but I really like the conversation. So thank you, Skylar, for sharing your insights as well.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Until next time, everybody.
Bye.